College. He's been here as an adjunct professor teaching biology in the past when he was here for a relatively brief period, 2 years. And since then, he's written a book for the InterVarsity Press. I had it up on my slide. Okay, it's up there. Mapping the Origins Debate. This is last time's presentation. I'm sorry about that. And so Jerry's going to speak to us tonight, and the topic of his talk tonight is the evolutionary atom? No. The atom of evolution. Okay, so that promises to be a fascinating presentation. So what are we doing in the future? Well, we are on a little bit of a break between our normal schedule of meetings, but we hope to have some kind of a field trip happening this summer. We've had some field trips in the past, apparently a really great field trip up to the Yerkes Observatory. Something like that might happen again. We haven't quite pinned that down, but keep your eyes on that email listserv that you hopefully have signed up. And if you'd like to be added to that listserv, but you're not already, this information is correct, go ahead and contact me at rodney.scott@wheaton.edu. Or if that's too hard to remember, my colleague Ray Lewis will also receive those emails, and his address is ray.lewis@wheaton.edu. So we welcome you to sign up for that listserv. We promise not to spam you, but we will keep you informed about all the things going on in the ASA. Okay, before I step down and turn things over to my colleague Ray Lewis, let me just say that we do this event relatively inexpensively, but we can use a little bit of help for honoraria and some other things setting up. We've got some snacks for us tonight, later on, if you join us for that. And so I'm going to just go ahead and get the contributions box started. It looks like an old cigar box, but it really is, you know, a very sacred, sacred receptacle of your willing love offering. And by the way, students are exempt from this. We figure you guys are in this period where you're relatively poor. But, you know, other folks, if you can afford a $5 donation, that would help us out greatly. Well, you know, we've all been there. We've done it. So. I don't have it on this slide, but we will have a little meet and greet up here. It'll take place on the stage. You can have your moment of fame if you want to, you know, recite a soliloquy or something. But at any rate, you'll get a chance to meet our speaker for the night and enjoy some cookies and some beverages and simply have a chance to interact with other folks. Okay, at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Ray Lewis.
Well, it's really a pleasure to have Dr. Gerald Rao with us this evening. I met Jerry a few years ago because we used to share an outer office area. And this is my 18th year here. First 14 years I taught from the stage, and we had a couple of years where we both taught classes in here. Nice to see some of my students here again, actually. Dr. Rao received his PhD in plant breeding from Cornell University in 1989, as you can read in the bio that we sent around with this. Has taught at the high school level for many years. In Taiwan. He received an MA in science education from the University of Michigan with a focus on the nature of science. And this is key to what he has brought to the interface of science and Christian faith. And so as he taught here, he brought with him an expertise that really helped us think about the issues. And some of the issues come back to the very basic, how do we even define science? He put many of these thoughts together in his book, Mapping the Origins Debate, and a book that just came out last year from InterVarsity Press. And we'll have copies of that available for purchase if you'd like. You might be able to weasel an autograph out of it as well. I don't think I've mentioned this to you, Jerry, but I've given this a couple of copies of that book away already. It's that kind of level of book that I found to be that helpful. One that I use the second year that I'm using in class as well. So returning back to the Arnerding Lecture Hall stage, where we both have taught many times and dealt with various things of this room. I'd like to welcome Dr. Jerry Rao to look at the atom of evolution.
And if it all works, we will have a PowerPoint. If not, there we go. We're all set. Is this on?
Doesn't seem
to be on.
It's not a very.
It doesn't do very much.
Is it on a little
is
bit?
Is it on at all?
It is on.
It is on a little bit. Okay, fine. Whatever it is. It's good to be back on the stage here. I don't know if I see any of my old students. Any of my previous students here? I think most of them have probably graduated. But tonight we're going to talk about the atom of evolution. You may have heard of a book by Peter Enns called The Evolution of Atom, which talks mostly about the evolution of the idea of Adam in Christian circles, in Christian theology. And so I sort of borrowed the title from him. But I'm going to talk more about the scientific aspect of it. Just to give you an overview of what to expect tonight, I'm going to talk a little bit about the... you going to try to turn this volume up or something?
Just a squeal.
Oh, yeah. Good. And to talk a little bit about the six models of origin, particularly about the three more theistic models that I think people here would be more interested in, and the theological presuppositions behind those, and a little bit about what I find as some scientific obstacles to each of those. After talking about the three better known models, just briefly, I'm going to spend a little more time talking about a new model, a developing model called non-Darwinian evolution, and then go from that into the idea of human origin, specifically human origin from a non-Darwinian perspective, some of the scientific evidence. I hope there's something in here that everybody can take something away. Some of it is really deep, heavy scientific stuff. Some of it is lighter level. So hopefully there'll be at least something in here for everybody. But let's begin with these six models of origins. Those of you who've seen the book know that I break this gradient of models from totally naturalistic to the young Earth position into six different categories, six different models. Some of these are based on scientific principles, some are based on theological, it's sort of a mix. So you have three different Darwinian evolutionary positions that are divided based on how they view God in the process, whether there is no God, whether he sort of kicked it and got it going, a deistic sort of position, or a more involved position. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have the two creation models, the young Earth and the old Earth. And then in the middle is this non-Darwinian evolution, which I'll talk about more later. Okay, now if you're familiar with this debate at all, you'll know that there's this other group called ID. You didn't see that up there anywhere, intelligent design. Why not? Well, as I view it, intelligent design is not really a scientific model. A scientific model is an explanation of the scientific evidence. And ID doesn't have a single model that they propose. Rather, ID is connected by their opposition to naturalism, particularly philosophical naturalism, but also methodological naturalism, and to Darwinism. And they affirm that design is empirically detectable, and therefore design should be part of science because it is empirically detectable. In terms of the models, most people within ID would identify themselves as old Earth creation, but there are a few on both sides of that as well. What I'm going to ask you to do tonight is to think inside the box. Now, a lot of people tell you to think outside the box. There's a problem with that. We're all outside somebody else's box. But they're in their box. And as they're in their box, there's only one opening. And they're looking out that opening. And if their opening is this direction, they see one thing. And if their opening is over here, they see something entirely different. And you cannot understand what they think and what they understand by looking down into their box and seeing them. The only way that you can understand what they're thinking is to climb inside that box with them and look out and see the world the way they see it. And so that's what I'm going to ask you to try to do tonight, is to think, to try to climb into some of these other views that may not be yours and understand why people would believe that, why they would see the world that way. Okay, so we're going to begin with Young Earth Creation. Well-known, many different Christian organizations, about 50% of the country supposedly believes in some sort of a young earth model. And their basic presupposition, and again, I want to stress this is a theological, philosophical presupposition from which they approach the data, is that the Bible is the Word of God. It doesn't change. Science is constantly changing. And as a result, we should interpret science in the light of the Bible and not the Bible in the light of science. And if you start from that basic presupposition, the position makes perfect sense. And so they look at Genesis 1 and they say, God called the light day, etc. And this was the first day, the second day, the third day. And they say, well, obviously, this was a 24-hour day. That's what the Bible is talking about. And so their proposed mechanism, as you know, is that creation happened in 6 literal 24-hour days about 6,000 years ago based on the numbers in the genealogies. Each kind was created separately. Adam was created on the 6th day. There was no death before the fall, and there was a worldwide flood in the time of Noah. That's about 4,500 years ago. Keep that number in mind because it'll come back later. Like right now. Okay? I took out a few slides here. Iridium and Ashley. Here are some issues that I have personally with young earth creation. There are many places around the world that there are very, very thin layers of iridium, micropectites, clay, other things, all in the same layers. And above that layer, you find lots of large mammals. You don't find any large mammals below it. Below that layer, you find lots of dinosaurs. You don't find any dinosaurs above that. That's evidence. And it's very hard for me to imagine how in a worldwide flood you have this very, very thin layer of all these things deposited out of this swirling mass of sediments. And then also, in between different layers of sediments, you have sometimes very thick layers of ash. And this ash, geologists can tell by looking at it, was deposited dry, like Pompeii. There's a place called Ash Fall State Park that has layers of ash tens of meters thick, and various animals trapped within that ash, buried just like the people in Pompeii. And I don't see personally how that could have happened in the middle of a worldwide flood with water deposited sediments below and above that, all in the same time period. And then you have other things like the Deccan Traps, where you have layer upon layer upon layer of different types of igneous rock built up mile thick over other sediments that are flood deposited sediments, and then eroded. And I say, did this really all happen, all of that volcanic activity and erosion and everything else, within 4,500 years? More than that, you have craters. You have about 200 craters around the world, huge craters, big enough so that the impact from those should have destroyed life on a large part of the planet. Those craters, in many cases, can be shown to impact through pre-existing sediments. They are then eroded. Sediments in many cases have filled those craters. Did this all happen within the last 4,500 years? And if so, why didn't anybody record any of those in any of the recorded history? And then the idea of no death before the fall. Did Adam and Eve never step on an ant? And I guess we don't count the bacteria in our gut that live and die within 20 minutes. They must not have been considered in that process. So I have a number of issues with that, as well as do a number of other Christians. And for a long time, I sort of switched over to an old earth position. Reasons to Believe, Hugh Ross is the biggest proponent of this in Christian circles at the moment. The basic presupposition of this is that there's no contradiction between God's revelation in the Bible and God's revelation in the world. And therefore, we have to find a way to harmonize the apparent old age of the earth with the linear structure that we see in Genesis 1. And so they say that billions of years is true, so this can't be a regular day. Now, when I show this, do you see any differences in this cartoon versus the other one that I showed about young Earth? Yes, just a few, like cross out instead of a highlight, a frown instead of a smile, even his thoughts are black. Okay, this is the kind of rhetoric that Christians use against each other sometimes. I don't like it. Okay, it doesn't, number one, it doesn't represent the position accurately. Number two, you know, we're supposed to be brothers and sisters in Christ. So I prefer to put them sort of all on the same footing. And really what they say is, considering the scientific evidence, day must be a long period of time. And so, according to this model, creation happened over billions of years, but God separately created many different things, including each individual body plan of different phyla. Adam was created perhaps up to 500,000 years ago. His disobedience brought spiritual death, but there had been physical death, obviously, for a long time before that. And perhaps there was a flood, but it was probably regional over the area that men existed in at that point, but not over the whole earth. Again, I have some questions that I've developed with this. One is plants before the sun. And the explanation for this that they give is, well, perhaps this is from the vantage point of someone on Earth. They're looking up, and there was a canopy of some sort, which parted at some point, the clouds parted, they could see the sun for the first time. Okay, there's still some problems. Whoops, going back. That it's inconsistent with the fossil record. That according to Genesis, land plants appeared before fish, which we don't see in the fossils. Birds appeared before land animals, which again is different from what we see in the fossils. So for them to say that the Genesis record perfectly follows the order of what we see in the scientific evidence, I don't see it. And then there was another argument which was used for many years where they said, you know, look at these bones. How many different mutations would it take to create all of these? All these different patterns. Well, what we know now is not many. That all you need to do is change the regulatory gene, change how long each of those bones grows, and you can form these different patterns very readily with very, very few changes. Okay, and then we get to Darwinian evolution. And within that, two of those categories are typically classified as theistic evolution. And I'm going to focus on one, which is sort of the more conservative end, promoted by the BioLogos Institute. They call it evolutionary creation to emphasize God's role in creation using an evolutionary method. I call it plant evolution because I'm focusing on the distinction, you know, the method. This is the method that's used, the evolution. But their basic presupposition is that science and religion are totally separate categories. They ask totally different questions, different methods, and so the Bible's not a scientific document. They don't address the same thing. The Bible answers who, science answers how. There's no problem because they are addressing totally different questions with totally different methods. Their interpretation of Genesis 1, yes, they do focus on Genesis 1 as well, but they don't look at day. They focus on the fact that God created. And that more than 30 times within Genesis 1, it says God, God, God. The focus seems to be on God more than on the method of the creation. That the Bible tells us who, not how. And so one very common interpretation of Genesis 1 is called a parallel interpretation, where Genesis 1:1 says, in the beginning the world was without form and void. And then throughout the days, God formed the earth and then filled the void, forming during days 1 through 3, filling, the parallel structure during days 4 through 6. There are other interpretations as well. John Walton, who's here, you may be familiar with his work, and several others that address it in slightly different ways. But all saying it's not a literal chronological order to the days. So the mechanism that's proposed then is evolution happened over billions of years. In terms of Adam, there was no historical Adam. Rather, there was a group of hominids that gradually became human. And after they became human, then sin brought on spiritual death. But again, I have some questions for evolutionary model as well. One is, I was a breeder, and I know that I bred tomatoes. And we could breed tomatoes to be, big, small, whatever trait we wanted. They were still tomatoes. And there was nothing we could do to push them past a certain limit. Evolutionists have looked at the beak of the finch and said, yeah, look at how much change we can create in the beak of the finch by environmental conditions, natural selection over a period of 10 years. Imagine what could happen over the course of millions of years. Well, that's just the problem. Can it go beyond that point? Certainly we as breeders have not, with our best efforts, been able to push it beyond a certain point in any trait. And then you have the question of the number of mutations. Population genetics has shown that just based on chance, the chance of positive mutations getting lost just by chance is very high. Depending on the selection, between 80 and 99.8% of all positive mutations are going to be lost just by chance. And that means that if you have, say, 100 traits that are different between two species, and it's considered positive gain, you need between 5 and 500 times that many positive mutations in order to get that many traits different between the two. So we've got a numbers game here that causes some problems. Okay, so let me introduce this idea of directed evolution from a non-Darwinian perspective. Directed evolution I show as being in the middle of this continuum. But perhaps it would be better to show it as sort of perpendicular. Because there are, just as there is with Darwinian evolution, there are naturalists. There are people who have absolutely no belief in God, who are promoting a non-Darwinian mechanism, and who think science is the main way of knowledge, Bible, maybe religion has some social value, but that's about it. And then the non-Darwinian evolution sort of draws a little bit from both sides in terms of their theological base. Basic presupposition in some ways is similar to old Earth creation in the views that there's an integration. You can't absolutely split science and the Bible. That we need to have an integrated knowledge. On the other hand, like the Darwinistic positions, tends to view that Genesis talks about who created rather than how, but there's this little asterisk, if you see there, that says, but Darwinian evolution doesn't have the how right. Okay, so what do I mean by that? Okay, neo-Darwinian evolution. Okay, not Darwinian. I use Darwinian just as a shorthand because neo-Darwinian all the time becomes very tiresome. But Darwinism has evolved a lot since the time of Darwin. what we now call the modern synthesis or neo-Darwinian, is based on five basic presuppositions or five basic tenets. One, variation. That's basically uncontested. That's evidence. There is variation among different organisms. Nobody disagrees with that. The middle three, natural selection, gradualism, and common descent, that's really the heart of the Darwinian model. And then you have the idea that evolution is undirected, and that's really a philosophical statement that science can't prove one way or the other. And in fact, as I've thought about it, I think it's actually like three different philosophical statements rolled into one. But that's not our focus tonight. Okay, so what about non-Darwinian? How does that differ? Well, neo-Darwinian, natural selection is the main agent of evolution. Natural selection is what moves evolution forward. It's based on variation, but that variation is random. And very small differences from one thing to another. What this means is that the change that's produced has to be gradual, and it will lead to common descent, things descending by small change from one another. And again, the assumption that that's undirected. Non-Darwinian says that natural selection is important, but natural selection does not produce innovation. Where does that innovation come from? Innovation comes from variation. And according to non-Darwinian evolution, that variation may be non-random. It may be directed in some sense, either by the individual or by God or by something. And it can therefore be saltational. It can be rapid. It can involve jumps rather than these slow steps. And therefore, again, change can be rapid. And you can have non-linear descent, meaning that there's much more emphasis on crossing over, things like horizontal gene transfer if you're in biology. And so, again, the conclusion then is that evolution is directed. Again, theists would say perhaps by God. Atheists would say there is something within the cell, within the organism itself, which directs change. It's a very Lamarckian view, which you may know is coming back as a result of some discoveries in epigenetics. So what about this source of variation? Where could this variation, this directed variation, come from? Well, there are about four different broad categories. If you have genes coming from other organisms, you get a rearrangement of genes within that organism. You can have differential expression of genes. And then there are things that are outside the genes that can also have factors, things like pattern formation, which are part of the environment. A little difficult here because both think marks on the genes as well as things totally outside the genes are both called epigenetic. I wish that weren't true, but it is. So something to keep in mind if you go further in this. This has then led to three different sort of branches of non-Darwinian hypotheses promoted by different people. Lynn Margulis and Frank Ryan and some others have focused on ecological associations, how things could change very rapidly based on symbiosis. Lynn Margulis, you may remember, endosymbiosis, and she has pursued this. Endosymbiosis finally came to be accepted as sort of standard biology now, but she continues to push this and say, no, symbiosis is far more important than we ever thought, and these components are borrowed from one organism to another, shared by different methods in this ecological association. Jane Shapiro, who I think talked here a couple months ago, has proposed a model based on stress-induced change, where the genes change teleologically. The organisms change in a direction, in a goal-driven way. And these genes are somehow then transferred to the gametes. And then evolutionary developmental biology, EvoDevo, has looked at those last two categories together in terms of developmental changes and how those might cause very rapid changes in an organism. Okay, so you might say, well, so what? So why is this non-Darwinian? I mean, after all, Darwin has sort of swallowed everything in its path. You know, all of these other, you know, neutral theory and punctuated equilibrium and horizontal gene transfer and everything has managed to be absorbed by Darwinism, and it still keeps on going. So why is this non-Darwinian? Very good question. It's because natural selection is still central to Darwin. It was central to Darwin in the beginning. He said it's the main but not the exclusive means of modification, and it continues to be central to Darwinism today. On the other hand, that is challenged by, for instance, James Shapiro. Selection is a purifying but not a creative force. And Mueller, speaking from an EvoDevo perspective, natural selection is challenged by EvoDevo. Okay, so this is a major conceptual shift, rejecting natural selection as the primary basis, the primary agent for evolution. Okay, also gradualism. Natural selection is accompanied by or leads to gradualism. Without gradualism, Darwin said it himself. Nature can't take leaps. She must proceed by the slowest and shortest steps. And he said, if it could be proven that that's not the case, then my theory falls apart. And those who are promoting these non-Darwinian positions are saying, let's take him at his word. And so they claim that there are different mechanisms. They say, yes, indeed, at the microevolutionary level, Darwinism works. When we're dealing with changes between, you know, closely related species, the things that we can see at the local level, yes, there is speciation that is caused by Darwinian mechanisms. But they say that there's probably different mechanisms operating at that deeper level, at the level of the differentiation of different phyla, classes, the larger groups of organisms, whether it's changes in chromosome structure, stress-induced, teleological, any of these different things, again, different models being proposed, which are not all mutually exclusive. It could be a mix of all those, but all of them challenge the primacy of Darwinism and say rather that it's at the level of variation. That's where we need to look, because without variation, selection has nothing to act on. Shapiro again. And Mueller, again, speaking from an EvoDevo perspective, says that much of the explanatory weight is moved away from natural selection and toward these other mechanisms that generate the variation to begin with. Okay, so what's the big difference? Well, everybody agrees, all evolutionists agree, that evolution cannot proceed randomly. There must be some non-random mechanism driving it, otherwise the numbers are too big. Okay? But according to Darwinian, the variation is random, and therefore it is natural selection that is this non-random agent which is shaping and pushing evolution forward. According to the non-Darwinian model, variation itself is non-random. And therefore, natural selection plays a far smaller role. It only sifts what's produced rather than being the real source of that change. Okay. take a quick break in your thoughts. We're going to change gears here. We're going to look very quickly now at the idea of the origin of humans. And again, particularly looking at it from a non-Darwinian perspective. Looking first at the idea of divergence from the apes. Okay, just to sort of set the stage, speaking in very broad brush strokes, there are a number of fossils of Australopithecans, and they're associated with a group of tools called Oldowan, which are just very rough-shaped rock tools. And then all of a sudden, you get a major change. You get skulls changing. You get a whole new set of tools that last for a long period during the period of Homo erectus. And then it's not until you get to the Neanderthal that you have tool sets with specialized tools for specialized purposes. And these are very distinct units that anthropologists, paleontologists will look at, will be able to find. Okay? So according to a Darwinian model, apes and human species diverge slowly, gradually, a result of accumulation of small genetic changes. But I say, and many others in this same camp say, well, maybe not. Maybe there were some major changes along the way. In fact, chromosome 2, you may have heard, is often used as a evidence for evolution, particularly Darwinian evolution. But I say that it's strong evidence against Darwinism. Let me explain. Chromosome 2 you may be familiar with. Apes have 24 pair of chromosomes, humans have 23. The difference seems to be that chromosome 2 appears to be a fusion of two ape chromosomes. The evidence for that is that in addition to the normal centromere, there's another section that has a base sequence similar to a centromere that's non-functional. And then in addition to the normal telomeres at the end of the cell, there's also a section in the middle right about where that fusion point would appear to be that is has telomeric sequence. Okay, now there's some problems with this, which are often not mentioned when people talk about Darwinian evolution. First, there's a very low likelihood of this fusion taking place. So even the proponents of this say that this probably happened, it was probably a singular event. It must have been inherited, it must have been in a germline cell, it couldn't have happened twice by chance, must have been a singular event. But that singular event is going to lead to problems with cell division. If the second centromere is not inactivated, you're going to have problems with mitosis. If it is, you'll have problems with meiosis. Again, let me show you. In normal meiotic, if this is the fusion chromosome, and we have two different centromeres, and they happen to split going the same direction, fine, no problem. But if that chromosome is twisted and they split, now we're going to have broken chromosomes. Okay? Now, is this a real problem? Well, supposedly up to half of the mitotic divisions could be broken chromosomes. And if that's the case, the offspring is undoubtedly going to be inviolate. Again, unless we have that second centromere inactivated. Well, can a centromere be inactivated? Well, it turns out there's a lot of research on this. It's called centromere repositioning. If you haven't heard of that, it's not surprising. It's a very small field of people. But they work with this, and they have looked at the idea that centromeres can change positions on a chromosome. Or in the case of a chromosome fusion, one of them could be inactivated, just as it would be if it were moved from one place to another. And there's a whole field of research on this. One particular recent research was looking at donkeys and zebras, which evolutionarily appear to have diverged fairly recently, but they have far different chromosome numbers, 62 versus 44. And their conclusion in looking at this, looking at the genetic sequence of each of these, is that there have been at least 5 cases of chromosome or centromere repositioning within the last 1 million years. So this is apparently a fairly common thing, and they conclude that this has potential consequences for speciation. Okay? Well, okay, so let's assume that that second centromere down here at the bottom is inactivated. If it's inactivated in meiosis, it's not going to pair with that other, if you have one fusion product and one parent that's non-fusion, it's not going to pair. So when meiosis takes place, these two will separate from one another. And then the second one, if it goes that way, everything's normal. If it goes with this fusion product, you're going to have either an extra chromosome or a missing chromosome in the gametes. If the genetics of this is kind of fuzzy in the background, don't worry about it. Just believe me, it's true. Okay. The result of all this is that you're going to have 4 different possible meiotic products. One of those is going to be have extra chromosomes, it's going to be inviable. One of those is going to have missing chromosomes, it's going to be inviable. One of those is going to be exactly like the parent, it's going to be viable, but there's not going to be any change. So only 1 out of 4 is actually going to produce gametes that will have this fusion chromosome and be able to go on and carry that on. Now, often, if you have very small, short chromosomes, because of the way they line up, they'll form these trivalents, the one long one and the 2 short ones, and meiosis will be normal. But in the case of the human chromosome 2 is one of the longest chromosomes around, and therefore it does tend to twist quite a bit, and you will very likely get products that maybe not exactly a quarter, but you will have some problems with meiosis. This was the conclusion also of a group that recently did a study on this fusion chromosome where they looked at it and then they said that the offspring would have had reduced fertility as a result of these meiotic problems. So it's not just me saying this. But there is a very, 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 did I say that often enough? There's a very, very, very limited body of research on fusion. There's a fair amount about inversions. Okay, inversions where part of the chromosome sort of turns up on its head. There's a lot of research. There's a theoretical framework. We know that as a result of this inversion, it reduces recombination and therefore reduces transfer from the parent type to the fusion, or the inverted, in this case, in the inverted type. And it's known that this can have a role in speciation because the reduced recombination means that the species will separate faster. And there are... There are 9 inversion differences between chimps and humans. Okay? But there's very little evidence or very little research on what happens with fusion. There's no theoretical background. There's very little work on its role in speciation. And yet if you look at, like donkeys and zebras, they're very closely related evolutionarily, and yet their chromosome numbers are different. And it seems to be the result of chromosome fusion in many cases. And any group, any genus that you look at, any small group of organisms, if you look at the species, you will find different chromosome numbers. And it's amazing to me that this has not been a major question. That's the major question for research. And yet, Well, I'm not the only one to think of that. This is, again, somebody from Evo Devo who says, well, these are very basic questions, but they're not even addressed. They're not even posed. They're not even examined by Darwinian evolution. Okay, so could this disadvantage, this meiotic problem be erased? Is there a way around it? Well, yes, if there's mating between the offspring of those individuals with a fusion chromosome, you would very rapidly form a new group that had this fusion chromosome. They would tend to mate with one another preferentially because that mating would be effective, whereas the other mating would have problems with reproduction, and therefore that would drive speciation very rapidly. Okay, so it would lead to very rapid speciation, and although there would be some introgression, it's called, some exchange of genes from the old population with the new, it would be a fairly rapid development of a new species. One more topic. Can you stick with me? Cognitive ability. Okay, I'm going to mention a number of different genes that are involved in this process. SRGAP2, FOXP2, the idea of new genes and transposable elements. This is getting really heavy into the biology, into the genetics. Sorry, I'm an applied geneticist by training. If you can't follow the specifics of it, just try to get the general picture. Just try to see what the general conclusions are without getting tied down in the genetics itself. SRGAP2 is a very interesting gene. It's ancient. You look back at many, many species way, way back, and it's very highly conserved. Almost all organisms have exactly the same gene. Why? Well, it regulates neuron differentiation and migration, and therefore it's rather important that things go right. But this particular gene is duplicated 4 times in humans. No other species that we know of has any other duplications. No other primates, no other animals that have been examined have more than one copy of SRGAP2. Humans have 4 copies or partial copies. One of them in particular, SRGAP2C, is an incomplete copy, appears based on molecular clock data to have been duplicated about 2.4 million years ago, and it's found in 100% of all of you have exactly the same SRGAP2C gene. So what? Okay. Well, that just happens to be the time where Australopithecus disappeared and Homo appeared on the scene. And the group that's been working on this suggests that this change, if this SRGAP2 appeared, it could have produced a major change in one generation. That's the key point, okay, to get the genetics. It could have produced a major change in one generation at birth. How, you ask? Well, because it interferes with this other normal SRGAP gene. And as a result, it produces genes that migrate faster, leading to larger brain size, that have a longer spine length, allowing greater integration of the signals, a higher spine number, allowing more connections between different neurons, and delayed spine maturity, meaning there's greater plasticity, greater ability for the brain to change and adapt to new situations. And this would happen to any organism that had this gene. It would be really interesting to transplant this gene into chimps or something and see what happens. Do you think it'll ever happen? Not in our current ethical status, and hopefully not. But it would be interesting, but it's not going to happen. So we have to just postulate based on what we can see based on the effects of the gene and in vitro. Okay, moving on to FOXP2. FOXP2 you're more likely to have heard of. It, again, is highly conserved. If you look at this chart, you see there the number in the denominator, the lower one, indicates the number of changes that are synonymous. Synonymous means that, yes, there are changes in the gene, but it doesn't make a difference in the protein because it substitutes, it swaps out an identical amino acid. It's just a change. So those type of changes are fairly common. But in humans, there are two changes, very uncommon, that are different, again, from all other related animals. Now, what does FOXP2 do? It allows us to move our face and mouth and vocal cords and all that stuff so that we can talk. Without that, if somebody has a defect in this gene, they can't talk properly because they can't move those muscles properly. Both copies, both of those changed copies are necessary for proper human speech. And it appears, again, based on molecular evidence, that there was a very rapid sweep in the population from the form that existed before in apes to the form that exists in humans about 200,000 years ago, which just happens to be about the time of the origin of modern humans, based on the fossil record. All right, third category, new genes. There are a lot of new genes in people. By one estimate, this is a group actually very close to here, the Manuen Long Research Group at University of Chicago has done a lot of work in this field. Zhang is part of that group. They estimate that there are 400 to 700 genes in humans that are unique. That's far more than new genes appeared in the same length of time since the divergence or apparent divergence from chimps. And another group, Doris, says that, yes, there's a great acceleration. You see, it's four times the normal rate of appearance of these genes. Now, new genes tend to be expressed in very few tissues. This is all human genes. Human genes, once they're in there, once there's a new gene, it tends to be expressed all over the place. But the new genes tend to be expressed in far fewer tissues. And a group that looked at this, Wu et al., found in particular that a lot of them were concentrated in the cerebral cortex. That's the part of our brain that allows us to do our thinking. In fact, how many? Well, again, different estimates, different numbers. It depends how you look at it, different groups doing work. So the numbers differ, but Chen et al. Found that 54 new genes appear to be active in the prefrontal cortex of people. Number four, transposable elements. Transposable elements are those things that jump around the DNA. Discovered by Barbara McClintock, people said she was crazy, then they gave her the Nobel Prize. And now we know that transposable elements make up about 44% of the human genome. For a long time, they were an evolutionary jump. They were viral material, essentially, that came in and then took over and was getting a free ride. But there are about 1 million LU elements in people. They're only found in primates. This particular transposable element is not found in any other types apart from primates. Make up about 10% of the genome. And these elements, as they jump around, they change gene expression. They increase the rate of recombination. And more recently, remember they used to be junk? And now Beaumont says they're a major player in evolution. And this is, again, becoming widely accepted. Okay? So since the branching from apes, there are about 7,000, more than 7,000 of these elements have appeared in humans, some 2,000 in chimpanzees, and they tend to be localized. 34% of them are within known genes. Many of those are, they're not random. They tend to be placed within the introns. And those introns are known now, they're not just cut out, they're not wasted. They are regulatory. They help to regulate the gene. They help to control how fast, how much of that gene product is produced. Okay, and if you look at the numbers, you look at the, there are 12 new types of allele. Allele is a group. It's not one particular element. It's a group that have some similarities. There are 12 new ones in people, and three of those are produced in huge numbers in people, and no other organism. Not even the closely related chimp. And chimps don't have, if they apply new types, but all of those are single copies. There seems to be something going on here with these transposable elements that is unique to humans. And so Britton et al. Conclude that these insertions underlie rapid human evolution. They believe that these allele insertions are key to human evolution. Okay, and if that weren't enough, some of these transposable elements, normally transposable elements are sort of shut down because you don't want them jumping all over and causing havoc. And yet, what we're finding recently is that even though they're normally inactivated by methylation, during brain development, some of them are reactivated. And the ones that are reactivated are particularly ones that affect cortical development. And so not all the cells in your brain are exactly the same, and the control mechanism of this is unknown, and yet it appears to be heritable. There's far more depth to this stuff than we have even begun to plumb with research. Okay, and so they affect protein-coded genes that are differential expressed and active in the brain. All right, so what does all this have to do with the atom of evolution? You know, you want to know where that title came from. Okay, here we go. I believe there is a lot of evidence that there has been rapid change in the human lineage. Particularly, it seems that the SRGAP2C gene was involved at just about the right time where the Homo genus appeared. It can't be proven that it's a result of that, but we do know that SRGAP2C produces larger brains, and that's one of the main features that distinguishes Homo from Australopithecus. FOXP2 appears just about the time that Homo sapiens appears, which just happens to be important because it allows speech, and speech allows the passing on of culture and all of the things associated with that. Speech, in many ways, is what makes us human. And then there are some other rapid changes. We don't know. We can't tell because we can't trace chromosome fusions and inversions with the same sort of techniques that we can point mutations. So we can't pinpoint a time for those the way we can some of the others. But we do know that at some point there were rapid changes. And we do know that when inversions happen, they often trigger a flood of transposable element activation at the same time. And so these things could all have happened in a very short period of time, that either the fusion or the inversion could have triggered a whole process of all of these other gene changes, duplications, etc., at any one of these points. It could have been a very, very rapid process. And each one of those changes had one individual. Now, where was Adam within that? I really don't know. Okay? But for those of you who are students in the audience, just over here, where the students are at, this is a potential research area. This is something you can get into evolutionary biology. You can look at these questions. You can investigate topics that people have not ever investigated before. It's a brand new field. It's an exploding field. And I think with great potential. And it does, as I say, I believe, allow for the possibility of a historical Adam within an evolutionary model. That there could have been a first individual who was so changed from any previous individual that when God gave his spirit, that person became human. Where, at what point that is, again, I don't know if we will know, but I believe that there is potential within this model for that, which has not been possible with other evolutionary models so far. Okay. Now you can breathe a sigh of relief, and I will take questions.
We've got about 20 minutes or so that we can take questions, and I really do like those to be questions first and not comments first. Well, there will be some time afterwards around punch and so on for comments, but mainly, you know, questions that might help clarify this or other ideas that might come up.
Yeah.
I got a very broad picture of what you said here. It occurred to me that some of the changes would have happened, needed to have happened both in male and female simultaneously. Very unlikely happenings, happening unlikely in a male, unlikely the same thing happening in a female, to happen at the same time.
Yep.
You're multiplying the improbabilities.
That's true. And in terms of a single happening, yeah, that's true. Fortunately, with my system here, it's not, there it is. It's unlikely that, and everybody agrees, it would be unlikely that it would happen twice because it's such a low probability.
And it had to happen at the same time.
Right. And if my computer will bring up the copies of the slides so I can see what I'm looking at in my thumbnails. Okay. So, yes, that's true. And yet, what you find is that in oogenesis, if one of these changes occurred, like a fusion or a inversion or whatever, in most cases, that's going to be a dead end if it happens in a female, because it's likely to be isolated in the polar body. That's what researchers show. If it happens, if that one change happens in a male, then first of all, that one spermatogonium will multiply many times and will produce both male and fusion gametes that could carry this. And therefore, the fusion of those male and female gametes, yeah, we're talking about inbreeding. We're talking about siblings marrying one another. But that could produce this new individual, and it could produce multiple individuals, okay, if it happens in a male. Now notice, if it happens in a male, we're talking Adam, okay? So that's one of the reasons that it excites me that it happened, it's most likely to happen in the male, and that then could lead to children that would be homozygous for this, and that would be the formation of the new species. Other questions?
Simplest question. I've heard the answer before, but it's been years I don't remember. You mentioned that the evidence for a flood would be perhaps regional, not worldwide. And what is that? And then secondarily, if that's the case, then what does that do for the students?
Okay. As far as the regionality, there's no, it's not so much that there's evidence for a regional flood as much as it's evidence against a worldwide flood. Some of the things that, I pointed out, and that's just a very small part of the scientific evidence. Geologists really have been pretty much convinced since the 19th century, even before radioactive dating, just based on the layers, just based on a lot of the geological features, that there was not a single worldwide flood. There's a lot of evidence that there's a good InterVarsity book that's about that thick that goes through that. Forget the name of it, but if you're interested, I could find it. Young and Sterling's Bible Rocks in Time. Does a very, very good job of showing why so few geologists believe flood geology. In terms of what that does to our interpretation of the Bible, well, again, if you view the Bible as literal history, that's a problem. But there are many other ways of, reading and interpreting Genesis 1. And again, the evolution of Adam, Peter Enns, does a very good job of looking at that, I think, in terms of he produced a piece that shows one way, and there are others, again, John Walton, different ways of reading the Genesis account that are not chronological, that basically say, well, you look at Genesis 1, and it talks about creation like 8 times. It talks about God like 30 times. What's the focus? The focus is not on how God created. The focus is on who created. If you look at the things that he created, all of those things that he created were worshipped in nations surrounding Israel. And so, as a story for the nation of Israel, it said, look, our God created all of these things. These are not gods. These are created beings. And that was the function of Genesis, not to say how God created. The people of those days were not scientific. They weren't concerned about the how, the way we are. They were concerned about the legitimacy of their God. And that was the reason that Genesis was written.
Do you have any comments on the family Cain and the family of Seth?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any study of the results of those two families?
No. Basically, the only account that we have of them is the biblical record. And again, what we do know of genealogies is genealogies are not complete in the Bible. If you look at the genealogies in the Old Testament, and you look at the genealogies in Matthew or Luke, you see that the genealogies in Matthew and Luke are not complete. They leave things out, but they don't say it. They just say there were 14 generations, 7 generations, whatever, between this and this. But if you look at the Old Testament, they left some things out. Why? They weren't concerned about numbers. They weren't concerned about historicity the way that we are. They were concerned more about truth in a different sense. They weren't concerned about literal historical truth. They told things in stories. All the ancient world told truth in stories. And that truth, the Iliad and the Odyssey, are those truths? Well, they were based on historical events. But
I asked a question about what it says in the Bible.
Okay. What it says in the Bible, it says in the Bible. But matching that with science, again, we can't match it with science because science can't cut that line. But it really depends on your interpretation of Genesis, whether Genesis was a historical record or whether Genesis was a record of the origin of the people of Israel and the fact that they were created by God, that they were protected by God, that they were called by God. So if you view it that way, then, again, they were not intended, perhaps, as historical literal documents.
I was asking the question about the genealogy between Seth and Jesus Christ.
Okay. Yeah.
Only that lineage.
Okay.
The devil tried to interfere with him. He was not successful.
Okay. The Lord. Yeah, and again, in terms of that genealogy, again, based on what we have in Matthew, there are some holes in it. There are some things that are not included. If you look back at the Old Testament records of the Kings, there are the same things that are listed in Matthew and Luke, and you see they're not all listed. That means that the genealogies are incomplete. So, was Jesus a descendant of Seth? Okay, fine. No problem with that. Were there some people missing in that lineage as it's recorded? I think probably so.
So, would you say that the capacity for correct evolution, like the capacity mechanisms such as transposable elements, evolve in a Darwinian manner? Or are you suggesting that direct evolution, like those mechanisms, always throughout the entire?
I would say that Darwinian evolution and non-Darwinian are both active, but at different levels. Most of the people that are looking at non-Darwinian evolution, they're looking at origin of new forms. And they are looking at changes at a basal level, whether that's a basal developmental level, whether it's a basal, part of the tree, whether it's organisms like parasites coming in and then becoming part of being assimilated into the body so that that organism changes in a major way. They're looking at those major changes. And they're saying that Darwinian evolution exists out on the twigs. That Darwinian evolution sifts what is produced by those changes, but that those changes are inherently directed. Again, whether Lamarckian somehow within that organism or directed by God, that depends on your perspective. But that the natural selection simply selects what's out there. But that the base change is happening at a deeper level, at that level of variation. Is that
sort of? So even like historically, the very early stages of evolution, like when the first cell would have developed or before after that,
Okay. The first cell is one of the bugaboos of evolution. Nobody knows. Nobody has any clue, really, how the first cell originated. It is so much more complex than any non-living matter. Even if you accept, okay, we could get all of this organic matter together in some sort of a bubble, the difference between a bubble of organic matter and a cell is just, it's astronomical. And no one has any real, it's a huge gap at this point. That's why we don't talk about abiogenesis in textbooks. That's why when evolutionists are questioned about the origin of life, they say, we're not talking about the origin of life. We're talking about what happened after life began and how it evolved after that, because nobody knows. It's really a huge unknown. And I think definitely that is a place, from my perspective, where God's hand is clearly evident. I don't see any possible way that you could have gone from inorganic matter to life without direction. Whether direct creation or, cook in the kitchen. Somehow, God did it. I don't see any way around that.
Question, when you talk about species that are being at risk, cutting down to getting to a few adults, a few members of that group. How does this approach work when you start out with one and then it diverges? Why is it the case that when you just pick up one or two, like rhinos and Africans, or smaller species, even though there are a few living members of that group?
Okay, so the question is how could we talk now about species being at risk when they're down to a few individuals, and how could it work if you have only one individual as the start of a species? Okay, well, remember, yes, you have one individual as the start of a species, but that individual can still breed with that other species for at least some period of time. That's the idea of introgression. That genes can be carried over. They are not fully fertile, but there would be the possibility of bringing in. So there still is an exchange of genes. At the same time, when you have a new species, if you had, for instance, an inversion, a chromosome fusion, that then releases the transposons and creates new genes, creates all kinds of new combinations of things that are going on, then you have a different situation than you have with a fully existing species now that is basically stagnant. So it's not an analogous situation. You have a lot of stuff. You have a lot of genetic movement, a lot of new genes being created that could be selected for a new environment. Whereas with the species that are at risk, basically there are no new genes. There's nothing new being created. They are not able to adapt to their new environment, to the changing environment. What we see in terms of a pattern in evolution is when there are great extinctions, the things that go extinct are all of the large animals, the large plants, the top predators. The things that emerge after that extinction emerge, okay, for instance, the mammals. Mammals existed during the age of the dinosaurs, but they were, you know, these little tiny rodent-like animals. And then all of a sudden, after the dinosaurs went extinct, we have this blossoming of different forms of mammals. And that's the sort of thing you see. But it's always from these basal, largely undifferentiated, very opportunistic, shall I say, species that are then able to change and adapt to that new environment. But the things that go extinct are the ones that are specialized to a particular environment. And that's what's happening today with the extinctions. Is that those specialized forms, their environment is changing and they can't adapt and they're dying out. If that were to happen on a broad scale, then probably what would happen eventually, if Christ didn't return, would be that we would have another round of adaptive radiation, and again, it would be from basal forms.
This is a question less about the science and more just asking that you have listened. Coming from an academic and a church background that are very opposed and attack each other very constantly, what are some ways that you have successfully approached a debate with people that are very polarized on both ends? That has helped open doors to spread knowledge. I
don't know. Okay, how do I approach the debate? Well, again, that's what I tried to do with the book. What I tried to do in the book, and I just, because I assume that a lot of people here have probably read it, maybe that's not true, I don't know, but I very clearly separated evidence from inference. So, the evidence, everybody's got to agree, it's out there. You can see it, you can feel it, you can touch it. how you interpret that is based in large part on the philosophical and theological presuppositions with which you view it. What box are you in? And how are you looking at it? Now, if I'm standing here and there were something, you know, between me and you, you'd see one thing, one side of it, I'd see the other, I might not even be able to see you. And that's the way it is with a lot of the evidence about evolution. That if I'm looking from a particular creation perspective, I may not even be able to see that other evidence. Whereas if I'm looking from the evolution perspective, I see a whole different box of evidence. And so what I have tried to do, and continue to try to do, is to say, look, here's the whole evidence. You are not dealing with it. Okay? And that's what, you know, if you saw the Ham Nye debate, that's what Ken Ham did not do. Well, Bill Nye said several times, can you explain this evidence? Can you explain this evidence? Can you explain this evidence? And he didn't. And, well, you know, to them, the evidence is the Bible. One particular interpretation of the Bible. And yeah, what we need to realize is people sometimes think science is based on evidence and the Bible is, you know, we read the Bible and it's just, it's there. I mean, we just read it. No, we don't just read it, we interpret it. We interpret it from a particular framework. Is it literal historical or is it parallel or is it figurative or is it, how do we interpret it? And there are ways to interpret the early chapters of Genesis that do not attack its inerrancy, that affirm its inerrancy, but that say, we as 21st century American Christians approach it from a 21st century American perspective, and that's not how the original readers read it. When we read the New Testament and we read these parables and we read the things that Jesus said, we try to figure out how do people who were there understand this? How do we do that with Genesis? And so I try to approach it graciously. In the book and in other lectures that I've presented on this, I say, here are the strengths of this position. And I affirm them. There are all sorts of problems. And people need to be aware of those and need to deal with it. And need to come up with an answer. And then, you know, as graciously as I can, I point out what I believe those are.
That's a great place to stop right now. Thanks. Thank you, Jerry. Thank you, tried and largely succeeded.